Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, John Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with a Professor, and our topic this week is going to be talking about student athletes in college, mostly football players, recruiting, all the things that are done, payment of players, all these different things. And nobody better to talk about that than Josh Lux, who wrote the book Illegal Procedure, also did the documentary The Business of Amateurs. And Josh, you know, since coming out with the show and along with the book, has things changed? Have they gotten better? I mean, we'll get into all the details as far as what it is like, but what seems to be the trend of things now, good, bad, or indifferent?
I think there's more conversation. So if you want to put a positive spin on that and say that there's more awareness to an issue, and hopefully that leads to change, that's great. I do think that change typically comes incrementally, and I don't think it's been enough time, sadly. You know, this is a system and a structure that's been in place for a very long time, what, since the 40s maybe, the 30s, I'm not sure exactly. I think it's right around then. It's not going to happen overnight, and, you know, as individuals have certain situations that come to light, the conversation will advance and the conversation will continue, and I think it's only a matter of time before the NCAA structure is going to have to be overhauled. I just don't think it's today or tomorrow.
And obviously so much of that is because, I mean, here the money keeps getting bigger. I guess focusing on college football, the money keeps getting bigger, but of course the money doesn't funnel down to the players, theoretically. And so can you envision a time where the stipends get better? Will college players be played, and should they be paid?
Well, I think first and foremost, you know, I do think they should get paid, obviously. I participated in paying them because there was clearly a market inefficiency, and being the capitalist that I am, you know, I saw a system that left their workforce desperate and broke. And so, you know, hey, if there's a need and I can fill it, then I will. And you know, does that make me a villain? Well, maybe at first I think it might have, but over time, I think people have come to see that maybe the system itself is to blame. Don't blame the bootlegger because there's prohibition. But in any case, I obviously think players should get paid, but equally as important, they should be recognized as employees of the universities so they have the opportunity to get health care and long-term benefits. They shouldn't have to turn to Pell Grants, which is nothing more than a form of taxpayer-subsidized welfare to fill the gaps that exist between the cost of full attendance and what the scholarship provides. And I read something recently, some propaganda that was put out by the NCAA, that now finally, they are going to be at a place where the cost of full attendance is on the table. You know, the individual conferences have taken it upon themselves to very slowly start to become more competitive with what they can offer with respect to subsidizing for living expenses and things of that nature. So little by little, there are some of the very things that I had pointed out that people like Jay Billis have always articulated. And Patrick Ruby and other great writers have brought to the forefront this issue and some solutions that needed to at least be considered. I think we're starting to see that now. And, you know, as far as the mechanism by which how players should get paid or will get paid will be something that's very complicated and something that would be debated heavily. But I think there's no debate when we're talking about long-term health care, because you don't have to play in the NFL to have head injuries or degenerative conditions in your knees or your back. And ultimately, somebody needs to pay to provide health care, and the billion-dollar enterprise is not on the hook. I think that's the bigger issue right now, and maybe that's the lowest-hanging fruit.
And obviously, the public sentiment seems to be more for the school than the player. And we watch that, particularly when there's that criticism out there that some fans accept of a player that doesn't go to a bowl game because he's going to be a potential first-round pick. And we've seen almost like on a yearly basis, one, two players suffer an injury in a meaningless bowl game. Again, if it's a significant championship bowl game, understandable, that can knock a pick out and knock his value down, say, five rounds. And you know, big money losses.
Well, I mean, for instance, people will point to the Band-Aid that's offered to these athletes in the form of injury protection insurance, career-ending insurance that I, by the way, find very curious because, and I think it's really self-serving that the NCAA won't allow an athlete to get a loan against his future value by rule. However, you can carve out this one aspect. If the player is able to get a loan to purchase career-ending insurance, they're able to do that in order for them to come back for another year of school to continue to generate income for the universities. So it's pretty self-serving that they can't get any sort of loans against their future value unless it helps the university. So the overall NCAA system. So it's also, I think, a little misleading. You know, the fans. I think what you said might be true in certain regions. But in certain areas, I think people are starting to be a little more open-minded to the reality of these different scenarios. The cost of loss of value policies is through the roof, and many of these athletes don't have loss of value policies. So like the linebacker from Notre Dame who got hurt with Jalen Smith, he'll never make that money back again. He may end up being healthy eventually and getting to a second contract, and all indications are that it seems from all the reports that I've read that he may be doing very well. Well, that's great, except he could have been the first or second pick in the entire draft. And how many dollars did he leave on the table? So loss of value policies, which are not typically used, would be a better solution, but they're almost cost prohibitive. And then there's the other issue, and I don't know how many people listening to this have tried to make sense of anything when trying to collect on a benefit from an insurance company. But let's just say that, whoever has the money rules, and they're not so quick to pay out. And there's arguments and ultimately settlements. And so if you do have a $3 million policy, it's not uncommon that it's negotiated down to far less, which doesn't quite make up for the losses that you'd receive by suffering that injury. And I think players are getting smarter. They're getting more educated. There's been talk of unionization that has first been approved and then shot down by the powers that be. But I think it's only a matter of time before that happens. And then a lot of these things hopefully will be back on the table for discussion to protect the athletes.
Let's get into education, of course, and going into the book, Illegal Procedure. And by the way, where is it available and where can people get Illegal Procedure?
Well, at this point, I believe it's on all the it's distributed through Amazon and all of the other places, BarnesandNoble.com and all the websites. Originally, when it came out in 2010, of course, it was in all the bookstores. But you and I both know they have limited shelf space, and unfortunately, there aren't that many bookstores left. Sadly, so everything seems like it's available online. It's distributed through Macmillan and published by Bloomsbury, so it's widely available.
And of course, being here in the city where Amazon is pretty well based, it's a good thing to mention Amazon because you can get just about anything. I mean, they just bought Whole Foods, for heaven's sake. All right, I'll open the eyes. When was the first time you were involved with players and how eye-opening it was? Take us back to the very beginning. Do you have an adjustable rate mortgage that is about to increase? or first and second mortgage that you would like to combine into one. Low mortgage payment? Hey, give Keel Mortgage a call today. They are local, friendly, and have been serving families up and down the West Coast for over 3 decades. With interest rates forecasted to rise, the best time to explore your options is now. It starts with a phone call to 1-888-778-KIEL or online at keelmortgage.com. That's Keel Mortgage, 888-778-KIEL. They can help. CL53969. Take us back to the very beginning with your involvement, not just as an agent,
man,
but with players, and then how eye-opening it was in paying players.
I got to tell you, I was super fan. You know, I grew up loving the Raiders, and they moved to Los Angeles shortly after my family and I moved from Brooklyn, New York to Los Angeles. My dad got us tickets. I started going to the games, and I absolutely fell in love with the team, if it's possible, even more than I was already. You know, I was a wide-eyed kid and listened to every interview. I'd cry when they lost. I mean, I was so into it and so passionate about it. And these players were up on a pedestal for me. I admired them. Listening to interviews with Todd Christensen and how insightful he was, and the Howie Longs of the world, and Marcus Allen, who was a USC guy here in Los Angeles and went on to the Raiders, and how he was able to you know, handle himself through the media and the persona that these players had, and they were larger than life people to me. They were heroes in many ways. And then I had the pleasure of working with a guy named Bud Ferrillo. I don't know if you remember the Steamer.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Bud Ferrillo was when newspapers were in their heyday. He was the sports editor for the Herald Examiner here in Los Angeles, and he was a radio host at KABC Radio, and I had an opportunity to meet him and start interning on his radio show and meeting all these different athletes. And Bud, you know, with our relationship, he leveraged that for me and got me an opportunity to be a ball boy with the Raiders for a summer. And I remember meeting my heroes, the Greg Townsends of the world and the Lyle Alzados, Lester Hayes, Mike Haynes. I mean, these guys were amazing. And then being there with them every day for a summer, I started to see the flaws. You know, that they're real human beings, that these guys who are wearing this armor and going out to battle were really imperfect. You know, seeing them with their wives one day and their girlfriends the next, it was something that I had never been exposed to, and I was shocked seeing the way they handled their business and answering phone calls there at the office when calls would come in. You know, from all these different folks from all different walks of life who were in their inner circles. It was an eye-opener for me. And then ultimately getting close relationships with who became my first client, which was Greg Townsend, which set me on a path to going out in the world and recruiting these guys. And so I went from that environment to suddenly hitting the road and trying to get players to consider working with me, along with some more established agents that I had aligned myself with at a very young age. And it became very clear that there was a lot of money that was getting floated around to these players, and that if I was going to have an opportunity to break into the industry, then I was going to need to come up with a bit of a war chest and make sure that I leveled the playing field. I didn't create the practice of paying players to sign with agents. Absolutely not. I wasn't the first, and I promise you, I wasn't the last. It became pretty clear to me that this is the system, and that if I was going to want to participate in this game, I was going to have to play by the same rules that these other people were playing by.
As it grew, I mean, you got to see how competitive it is, both for getting players that are in the league, but also in college, which even now seems to be amazing, because if you're going to be getting a decent player in college, I mean, you're starting with paying their training, basically paying for their off season, and then giving them a little bit more money.
Absolutely. And, you know, and so people understand who are listening, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I mean, that's standard practice. That's allowed by the rules. Once they've decided they're coming out, you know, paying for the training, you got a strength coach, a nutritionist, a track coach, you could be in $30,000 to $50,000 over that 6 to 9 month draft period without any promise that the player is going to elevate his stock. And in some cases, the guys get unfortunately tagged with positive drug tests, or they end up finding themselves in bad situations and having issues with family, women, you know, run-ins with the police. It's an investment that's a very risky one when you're dealing with immature, soon-to-be multimillionaires. I kind of considered myself at the time the highest paid babysitter of all time, because I felt like that's exactly what I was. And sometimes I was great at it and able to help these guys stay out of their own way. And sometimes nobody could, whether it be the greatest coach or the closest family member or mentor. Sometimes guys just can't stay out of their own way. And it was a very different business when you're dealing with recruiting already established professionals as opposed to recruiting the college talent. It was two different businesses, almost had two different seasons, and there were completely different rules and costs associated with both.
I'm sure the word hypocrisy from a lot of the things that you've heard before that you were doing that, as far as what people thought were going on. What were some of the things that, you know, maybe some of the worst things that you've witnessed through the years?
Wow, that's a pretty loaded question, John. I mean, the worst things? I mean,
yeah.
Do I list that alphabetically or do you want it numerically? I mean, how do I answer that? And again, that's also very subjective. But one of the things that really shocked me was the people that were supposed to be the closest to these athletes, the family members, an uncle, a cousin, somebody who the player would grow up with, who would inject themselves into the process. And initially, they were taking the role of buffer or gatekeeper, but they would ultimately, most of the time, figure out a way to get themselves in the mix and either try to represent him themselves or get a payoff in many cases from an agent in the form of direct payment or possibly a job with the agency. Those are the things that really irked me, when the family members would have their hand out and not be looking out for the best interest of the athlete, of the prospect. The other thing that really shocked me was the sheer incompetence or disinterest of the NFL Players Association and how corrupt I found them to be. Now, people could say my statement is somewhat self-serving because I was suspended, but remember, I wasn't suspended by the union for any of the stuff that I admitted to in the book or in Sports Illustrated or anywhere else. They suspended me for an agent dispute and not all the payoffs that I made to coaches or players through the years in the recruiting process. So, you know, when you look from the outside, everybody just gets the best football that money can buy. It's sort of like not wanting to know how the sausage is made. It's delicious. Let's enjoy it. But I don't want to really know how it's made. And it's pretty gross, man.
Oh, I can imagine. Now, do you see things getting any better, or is it just going to continue on this cycle until, particularly for college players, there is some kind of payment system for them? And even if there is a payment system, it may not be enough.
Well, it's never going to be enough because, you know, perception is always reality for these people. And, you know, we are groomed here in the United States. It's about capitalism, you know, and you work hard, you succeed, you get more. Everybody wants more. Everybody thinks that they are entitled to more than the next guy, assuming that they outperform the next guy. And, you know, maybe that. There's some truth to that, even when it relates to what's supposed to be amateur sports, which, by the way, I don't believe in the word or the phrase a student athlete. I mean, it's a phrase that was coined by Walter Byers, who was either president of the NCAA or whatnot. He admitted in his book that he created the term student athlete simply to help to avoid having to pay workers' compensation benefits to the athletes, in part. So, you know, and there is no legal definition for student athlete, or I think amateur for that nature. So, you know, everybody has this idea of who these guys are and what they should do. And I'm hoping that things change in time. But until the structure itself changes and allows for reality of the time that we're living in with Twitter and everything else and all of the multimedia and the platforms that these players have, they are more accessible than ever before. Their value continues to grow during a period of time when they're playing college athletics. For many of them, the height of their popularity nationally is during the time that they're playing college sports. And unfortunately, with today's system, they cannot capitalize on that. They have no opportunity to cash in. Only the NCAA does and the member institutions. And I think until that changes and the system addresses the times that we're in, I think we're going to continue to have problems. And I don't think it's going to get any better anytime soon.
The book is Illegal Procedure. You can get it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Go back. It's a 2010 classic. And you're also part of the video and the documentary, The Business of Athletes. One final thought. Business of Amateurs. And where can you get that at?
I think you can see that on Hulu now and Amazon Prime. It was done by a former USC offensive lineman named Bob DeMars. And he really, you know, focused on not just the pay for play scandals, but he also went into the head injuries, CTE, and the impact that that's going to have on players. And he followed some guys as they were going through, you know, their personal struggles. And it's fascinating and probably the most in-depth of any documentary I've seen. And I strongly urge anybody who cares about these issues to track that thing down on Hulu or Amazon and check it out. It's fascinating.
The Business of Amateurs. And, of course, my favorite scene I've seen you do was one time that the book was already out. You were all in the news. You were at USC. They had closed things off, and you had a camera and a camera crew that you went right up to the cars where the players were. It was incredible.
That's right. That's right. Well, that was I think, Real Sports. That was HBO.
Yeah, yeah.
I had the opportunity I take that back. It was The Dotted Line, one of the ESPN films in the 30 for 30 series. And I did drive up, and I wanted to show people how easy it was to access these athletes for people like me that were trying to. Everybody thinks there are these compliance officers who are running around almost like cops trying to protect the athletes from, you know, outside influences, and the coaches, and everybody's watching these guys and trying to protect their interests. Well, they're not. They're not. Everybody looks the other way because the system relies on, in my opinion, these players being able to subsidize themselves. Finding these players, the greatest athletes don't always come from affluent environments. And as long as that shortfall exists and the families aren't able to help to support and subsidize these athletes, they are going to be looking for a way to fill that gap. And so I drove my car up there, and it was a big Mercedes, and I was wearing a suit. So here's this big guy in a big Mercedes with a bunch of cameras standing right outside the practice field, and any player that came off the practice field has to walk by me to go to the locker room or the weight room. And I just wanted to show people how easy it was to do that, and it was at UCLA, and I could have done it at USC. I could have done it at Tennessee and had. I'd done it everywhere. It was no different anywhere. You know, these players are going to classes. I jokingly, and I think I talked about this in the book as well, and I know I've done this in some of the lectures that I've done. I talked about the way that we would find athletes, the way that we would track them down before there was the internet and Facebook and all these other ways that we could reach players through the internet. we would have to, and I don't need to be crass here, but we would find the fat chick. And the fat chick was some girl who was always outside of the athletic department. Former athletes, anybody listening, they know what I'm talking about. She's wearing a warm-up with the team logo on it from the university. She's in love with half the players. She knows where every guy is every hour of the day. She's like a navigation system to the athletes. And if you find that girl and sit down with her for 5 minutes, you'll know exactly where to find each player at any hour of the day. And nowadays, a modern day version of that is what we have available to us on the internet. People are now ghosting. Athletes are now clicking on and accepting friend requests and invitations from good-looking girls.
Unbelievable story. Hey, Josh, thank you so much. Always great talking to you.
Okay. All right, my pleasure. Bye-bye.